everyone, and welcome to American Girl Unboxed, the podcast where we dive deep into the stories, styles, crafts, and snacks of the American girls we grew up with. I'm Grace, and today we're recording a super special Halloween episode. I'm here with Katie to talk about Samantha's mystery books. Katie and I both read The Curse of Ravenscourt by Sarah Masters Buckey. Katie, did you read these books as a kid?
I read The Curse of Ravenscourt and one of the other mysteries, which was The Stolen Sapphire. That is a Samantha one as well.
Do you remember that one at all?
I don't remember the, I mean, obviously the title alone gives away what the mystery is, but I don't actually remember that one as much as The Curse of Ravenscourt. And The Curse of Ravenscourt was the first mystery American Girl book I do remember reading, so...
And you are the one who recommended we read this one for Halloween because you remembered it being a little spooky.
I do. Yeah. So I remembered the general vibes of this book, but I still forgot some pieces of information. So it was still good to reread and dive back in.
This is a mystery. So I'm going to be curious throughout, like, if you remember certain details or not. So I'll be picking your brain.
I was trying to remember too. And I think I kept convincing myself of one thing throughout the book. But
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we're going to give some background first on the series. In 1999, The Smuggler's Treasure was published as the first in the American Girl History mystery series. This was a series of 22 books that were not related to the specific characters, but they were mysteries, so similar to the one that we just read, just not featuring a specific girl. It seems like the series ran until 2003. The historical character mysteries were introduced in 2005, with the books in that year featuring Kaya, Samantha, Kit, and Molly. This series went until 2019, and all of the historical characters were featured up through Nenea. So you can get at least one book for each historical character through Nenea. I think the girl with the most historical mysteries is Kit. They are not like evenly spread. So some girls have one, some girls have two. Kit, I want to say, has around seven. So, and Samantha has five. So there was a new graphic novel series introduced in 2023 called Mysteries Across Time, where a modern girl would discover the journal of one of the historical girls and help solve a mystery.
Ooh, fourth wall.
I know. They sound fun to me. And the first book did come out. It was Julie and the Blue Guitar. And it is still available to purchase, and I do want to check it out. But there was a second book planned called Isabel and Nikki versus the Bigfoot Bandit. But it seems like that may have been scrapped because it has not been released.
So, interesting.
Yeah. A little bit bummed because I feel like that would be a fun series, but maybe there's still room for it to grow. We'll
see. Take off.
And we're going to do, since this is our Halloween episode and we're reading somewhat of a spooky book, we're going to do a little bit of history into Halloween at that time and some other spooky historical facts. So, Katie, do you have anything to share about Halloween in the early 1900s?
Yes. So even though this book was not set during Halloween, it gives definitely spooky vibes, Halloween vibes. I think just mysteries in general kind of have that vibe. So I was curious about Halloween in the early 1900s. And according to an article from Smithsonian Magazine, Halloween during Samantha's time was mostly tricks in the trick or treat. So teenagers especially were causing mischief, playing pranks on people. And some of these pranks that were listed included tripping people in the dark, tying doorknobs of opposite apartments together. So those two are relatively harmless, rattling and soaping windows, and then some more detrimental ones that I didn't really want to list. So some of these pranks originated from Irish and Scottish immigrants that were bringing their Halloween superstitions to America during the 18th and 19th centuries. And it said as well that the local grouch was often the target of Halloween pranks. So I just thought that was kind of a funny trope that carries throughout literature and movies and things over time.
I think it's cool to hear about things being brought over from potentially Irish and Scottish immigrants, because I actually want to do my own deep dive, and I have it, to see how other countries celebrate Halloween, because I know that like the way that we do it in America, I think, is fairly specific to America.
Yeah.
And I know I've like heard Australians, for example, talk about how sometimes like kids will want to celebrate Halloween and they're like, we don't really do
we
that.
We don't do that.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious if there are other countries celebrate it as we do, but.
Yeah, and I was actually kind of struggling a little bit to find some of this information. Just, I mean, historical information in general, I feel like, can be tricky to find if you're just looking online. But yeah, it did seem like it was kind of specific to Europe and then America as well. But I would also love to do a deep dive on Halloween, because I do feel like most of the movies or most of the literature that surrounds Halloween is definitely set either in America or like just Europe in general. Like I think of Frankenstein, and I think that's set in Europe,
but I don't know that that's country Halloween,
but it's not, but it's been adopted to Halloween. Yeah. So I feel like
it's
somehow those might be connected, or that lore might be connected with monsters. I don't really know. So if anybody has some recommendations for us, please DM us for us to get our Halloween research on.
Yeah.
But also, kind of from my research, it looked as if kids and teens and sometimes adults in the Victorian era would also dress up in costumes as mythical creatures. So witches, fairies, ghosts, or as professions, firemen and doctors. And Halloween parties were pretty common, really trying to rebrand Halloween as more of a party holiday and not tricks and pranks, even though those still occurred. And it said the more drama, the better, especially for entrances. So it's just reminded me of Grand Mary's like elaborate Christmas celebrations.
Mm, yeah.
And it said common parlor games included apple bobbing, mere divinations. And if you don't know what a divination is, it's telling the future by interpreting symbols. Mm. So looking in the mirror for symbols for your future, and jumping over candles, which seems really safe with all those Victorian skirts. So those were just a few. And I can imagine those Victorian Halloween parties would just be such a vibe.
Yeah, that I would love to see. I love fall movie content, specifically cozy, like kid family movie content. I would love to have a movie set during this time, set at Halloween, but it not be creepy or like maybe creepy, but not scary. You know, that would be so fun to watch.
Yeah. And I think I always think of like the Victorian, or maybe it's from another area, but the plague masks.
Oh, yeah.
Those always just stand out to me as so spooky, and it was just such like a commonplace occurrence. But now I associate those with Halloween, or see people dressing up in kind of this Victorian garb that I think was normalized, but now seems like even more spooky than it maybe was in the time. And so I think of all those plague masks. But then I also, when I was doing my research, saw a picture of a ghost that was pretty terrifying as a costume. It was just, it looked like they had paper mache their face and were wearing all white. So it was very, I feel like just the level of craftsmanship for costumes was a little different in that era. So they do definitely give, to me, a more spooky vibe.
Yeah, you probably can just go to Walmart and get a Power Ranger costume back then.
Oh, so you know, not
you're
at
getting
all
creative. I know. Did you ever watch what is it called? The Haunting of Bly Manor on Netflix?
I don't remember.
It's like, did you ever watch The Haunting of Hill House?
No.
It's really good. I highly recommend these series. If y'all haven't watched these, they are perfect for the fall. They are kind of scary. They're actually scary, though. So they're not, I would not watch it with a child. But there's like a plague doctor in the Bly Manor series, and it's just so creepy. But I do love, like I said, I love all, like I love fall content. I love spooky movies, but I don't like super scary stuff. In the 1900s, though, they did like some creepy, scary stuff. And one thing that they were really into were seances. And so this was very popular. And in sort of response to that, there were also ghost shows that were created where actors would fake being ghosts by like trick lighting, but then at the end of the show they would explain how they created that effect. And a lot of the motivation, it seems like, for those performances was to debunk a lot of this seance stuff, because the performers often felt like mediums were frauds preying on the public. So kind of interesting that you could either go to a seance, which was sort of, you know, trying to have realistic vibes of ghosts, and versus these ghost shows, which was the opposite of that.
Yeah, very interesting. Just picturing Samantha and her friends with like a Ouija board or like,
oh yeah,
trying to contact the dead. I mean, like, that just seems like so, I don't know, out of place for that time period, but I guess not.
Did you ever, I'm gonna probably just this whole episode be mentioning other movies and stuff, but did you ever watch the movie The Others?
No. Okay. I am notorious for somebody saying, did you watch X, and just not having watched it. So apologies. That's going to probably be my answer.
I feel like The Others is not one that I would expect people who aren't my age specifically to have yes. seen, because it's very much like one of those B films that came out in 2001 that everyone my age pretty much went to go see it because it was like the spooky movie that you could go watch at that time. But anyway, it's a movie with Nicole Kidman. I do recommend it. But there are some like really spooky seance scenes that just made me think of, like, it just reminded me of like learning about the seances from the early 1900s. Although okay. I do think it's set a little bit later on. But anyway, did you have some facts too about that relate to this book with anything spooky?
Yes. This book single-handedly when I was a kid caused my elevator fear. So yeah, another just piece of information from the back of the book here, and thing that I think was common was that people were afraid of early 1900s elevators. And so in the beginning, they were only used to carry freight and not people, so that nobody would be killed if a cable broke or injured. But by Samantha's time, they were much safer. And even the book kind of mentions this later on, that they used old elevators for the service elevators and safety elevators for the guests. So
which is super messed up.
Super messed up. And I did not read the back of the book as a kid, so I think I just thought that elevators were prone to crashing. And so I'm glad I read it this time. But I think especially I've always been a little weary since I haven't prevented myself from riding an elevator. But there have been some rickety ones that I'm like, when was this installed?
I did do a deep dive, I remember, on elevators maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, just because I was curious. They kind of creeped me out too. And so I was curious actually what are the stats. And it made me feel a little bit better to learn what the actual stats are of people who die in elevators. So Katie, what would you guess? Like how many people a year do you think die in an elevator?
I feel like now the number's probably like close to nothing. Maybe not. I don't know. Grace is making a face at me. You guys can't see that. But I would think that it's definitely decreased over time, but I would still guess there's probably like tens of elevator deaths a year just because there's accidents that happen and nothing mechanical is perfect. So,
yeah, you are correct. There are tens of them. There are about 30 a year.
Okay.
I learned this info from a bunch of law firms. Like when you Google elevator deaths.
Oh, I'm sure.
The first literally like 30 or 40 links were all from law firms. They're like,
did you get crushed by an elevator?
Right.
Call 1-800.
There was one of them that said that this data comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, okay. And again, so many places cited it, so I would imagine it is accurate. But it says there are about 30 deaths a year from elevators. About half of these are from the maintenance people. So It might be from like getting electrocuted or falling down the shaft like while they're fixing it.
Okay.
So not something like it's horrible that happens, but not necessarily something most people will have to worry about on a day to day when getting into an elevator. The other half of the deaths are related typically to accidents, like someone getting into an elevator without looking and there's no elevator there, so they fall down the shaft. Just like kind of freak accidents like that. Again, super rare. If you think about like how often people ride elevators and then that number being only 30 deaths a year, the chances of dying due to an elevator related incident is like less than getting hit by lightning or getting attacked by a shark, for example. So it's very rare that that would happen. And as far as like someone dying from like an elevator plummeting, that hasn't happened since 1932. That happened in Brazil was the last time. But as Katie mentioned, there have been a lot of safety features put in place since then where there's like an emergency brake and things like that to prevent someone, an elevator plummeting in that way.
And yet my fear persists.
I don't blame you. It's just, it feels unnatural to.
100%. Yeah. And then along the lines of elevators as well, this book also goes into the unlucky number 13 and mentions the building that Samantha was staying in. And then also other skyscrapers and buildings at this time period were being built taller, often because elevators could bring people up to more floors. So you don't have to take 13 flights of stairs to get up. And so buildings, depending on what they were, might have had the numbering of the floors start on the second floor or on the ground floor. And in this case, the book starts with the ground floor and then the floors are labeled starting at floor two. So floor two is labeled floor one. And that's usually if a building was taller than 13 floors or had 13 floors.
If a building was exactly 13 floors, they would often, I think, start like the second story as floor one. So that way, like the top floor would be floor 12 versus floor 13, which is what happens in Samantha's book.
Right. And then if it's taller than that, they just kind of skip the number 13 altogether. And it's sad that some like modern builders even do this. And so I do remember after reading this book as a kid, like incessantly checking if the hotels we were staying at had the number 13. And I don't think we were ever usually staying in hotels that had more than 10 floors, but definitely something that I think is interesting, superstitious wise, that still exists.
And that would be something else I'd be curious to look into is like the number 13. Where did that stem from? Is it a superstition? Is that an American thing? Is that from Europe? Like where does that come from?
Yeah, what's the significance, the numerology behind that?
I will say something that is potentially sort of American specific, or it's definitely not ubiquitous throughout every country, is how we label floors. Because I want to say I've been to a handful of countries over in Europe, and I want to say some of them will start, they'll number floors like Samantha's building does, where the ground floor is the ground floor. And then what we would consider the second floor is the first floor. So I remember, I forget what country I was in, but I remember being confused because of that system. But so when we talk about this, you know, if there's a listener who's not from America, it maybe is different where you are. But
I certainly love the star next to any elevator button that tells me where the ground is. So
just tell me how to get out of this building.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's jump into the book.
All right.
So this book was set in November of 1906, which would place it about 9 months after the last book that we read. And Samantha is currently 11 in this book. The book starts with Samantha and Nellie searching their house. And remember, they're now with Uncle Gard and Aunt Cornelia. And they're searching for Jenny, who is Nellie, well, Aunt Samantha's little sister now. And when they find her, she is hiding because she doesn't want to leave to go stay in a hotel for a few weeks while construction is finished in their home. Samantha asks Nellie why Jenny is having a hard time, and Nellie explains how they've been so happy there that Jenny doesn't want to leave. And honestly, like right away, I was already tearing up a little bit. I was just because just thinking about the traumatic backstory that Nellie and her two sisters have.
Yes. And now they're leaving again.
Yeah. So I totally already, they caught me in the feels. I was like, okay, I'm already into this book. It sucked me right in. And now that Uncle Gard and Aunt Cornelia went from having zero kids to four daughters, they are renovating their home to make it bigger. The attic will become two bedrooms and a bathroom for the four girls to share.
And I just thought this was so interesting. I think at this point in the book too, I was like, what does Uncle Gard do? Because to go from zero to four daughters and then having the funds to just willy-nilly renovate their house, a brownstone in New York probably as well. It's just like, what type of generational wealth or profession does he have here? And it does tell us later on that Uncle Gard is a lawyer. So that kind of checked out for me.
Yeah.
On all areas.
I was wondering if we had that information before, because I wrote that piece down that he was a lawyer, and I was like, I don't think we knew that, but I can't remember if we did or not.
I don't think we did, but he definitely gives like high profile businessman, lawyer, like personality, I feel like.
Yeah. In previous books, I had talked a little bit about the history of like women working at this time, but I didn't look into, and I wish I would have, like, if someone comes from generational wealth, like the women wouldn't have been working, but like what would the men be doing? Like, clearly in this case, he was a lawyer. So what, you know, what was common for men who come from generational wealth? How does all that work? And so it's that piece is kind of interesting. So it was cool to have a little bit more of backstory on Uncle Gard and what he does. But yeah, they clearly have enough money to take on this huge change for their family.
Yes.
So back to the story. Samantha is being a little bit clueless and talking about how excited she is to go to the hotel and how she's always wanted to live in an apartment. And like while I was reading that, I was like, girl, think with your brain.
Yeah.
You're acting all excited about going to an apartment.
Remember the last one you were in?
Book six. It wasn't that long ago.
No.
Nellie and her sisters have, of course, lived in an apartment before, and it was not a great experience. They've lived in multiple, and we heard the backstory. And again, not a great experience in any of those situations. So they take Uncle Gard's car to the new apartment, Raven's Court, which is tall and elaborate. Each corner of the building is adorned with a carved raven with its wings spread.
Spooky.
Yes. Samantha is excited, but when she looks over at Nellie, her face is full of fear. Nellie says that she's seen ravens like that before and they always bring bad luck.
I feel like Nellie has just lived 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond her character's age. More than that. 10 lives. That's what I meant to say. I just feel like she's so wise.
She is. And this book, there's a lot of mentions to Nellie and how she is reacting to a situation that Samantha's like reacting differently. And she's like, oh, but I noticed that Nellie is looking scared. And clearly Nellie is picking up on things faster than Samantha.
But Samantha's maybe becoming a little bit more perceptive or looking to Nellie to kind of figure things out a little bit more instead of just jumping in.
Yes. Good point. We're starting chapter two now, where they enter the hotel, which is very empty. A redheaded doorman ushers them in and introduces them to the manager of the hotel, Mr. Winthrop. It turns out Uncle Gard is at the... So this is where we learn that Uncle Gard is the lawyer because he is at the same law firm as Mr. Raven's lawyer, who was the one who suggested that they stay there. There are many vacancies at this hotel or at this apartment because there have been some unexpected occurrences such as... There are many vacancies at this apartment slash hotel. I think it's a hotel, but like it's a special hotel where you stay for long periods of time.
I kept wondering about that too, because they kept referring to it as an apartment hotel.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if that was like you said, where it was a longer period of time or whether it was just the name for like a 1 year lease or something, or if it was more so like a hotel was seen as one room and then the apartment hotels had all of these extra rooms associated
like
with
suites.
Yeah, kind of. Like a suite.
Yeah, that's a good point. I honestly wasn't really clear, but
it was not. And we didn't research it.
No, sorry. So in this place, yes, there are a lot of vacancies because there have been some unexpected occurrences since recently opening. So already I was getting some spooky vibes, like just from like the how they described this place and then the fact that there's been some sort of mysterious negative things happening. They enter into an elevator and go to the 12th floor. It is the O'Malley sisters' first trip in an elevator and they are a little scared. There is only one other apartment on the 12th floor and that is Mr. Raven's. When they get inside their apartment, they are greeted by their new maid, Mary Crosby, as well as their grumpy housekeeper, Gertrude, who arrived earlier, and she was in some previous books. Aunt Cornelia is said to look tired with dark circles under her eyes. Right away, I read that, and I was like, oh, she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Is that what you thought? Or
I definitely not as a kid, I think, it went over my head again, which I had the thought as an adult. I was like, Cornelia is pregnant. Like, there's so much foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Like, that was pretty obvious to me. But then I was like, how do these girls, particularly Samantha, keep getting duped by pregnant women in the Victorian era? I have some thoughts about that later. But
okay. Yeah, I was wondering. I'm sure as a kid, I would not have picked up on it. But like, I think as an adult, you just learn if you see a woman puking on the screen, she's pregnant. If you see her mentioned that she looks extra tired, she's pregnant. Like, there's just all these things now that we are
attuned to.
Yes. So Samantha and Nellie will share a room at their new place. And then they also get to meet their cook, Mrs. Calloway. So like this apartment comes with a maid, a cook, and then they have their old housekeeper there as well. Uncle Gard takes the girls up to the roof, which has a pretty view. And then when they go back inside, Mr. Raven, who has a limp, and I did try to note like random things like that, because as I was reading, I was like, anything that I knew this was a mystery. So I was like, anything that might involve the mystery, I'm just going to add it in. So Mr. Raven does have a limp. Maybe that will matter, maybe it won't. And then he also has his daughter with him, Eloise, who just graduated from the same school Cornelia went to.
And I feel like the limp, I would have noted as well, because that's always the characteristic of the spooky, suspicious character.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of interesting because he just disappears.
Yeah. A lot of the adults in this book end up disappearing.
Yes.
Mr. Raven talks about how he purposefully built his building next to a rival's apartment building and made his purposefully just a little bit taller.
Petty.
Yes. While they all chat, Samantha notices that Nellie looks very worried. When Mr. Raven and Eloise leave, Nellie finally confesses that she knows Mr. Raven and he is a terrible man. So that's the end of chapter two. Chapter three, Nellie explains that Mr. Raven was a terrible landlord who owned the building across from where she used to live with her family. One of the tenants was an old woman. This part is so sad.
I know.
One of the tenants was an old woman who lost her grandbaby due to their living quarters being too cold. When Mr. Raven came the next day to collect rent, she cursed him and he ended up falling down the stairs, giving him his limp. Mary, the maid, overhears them talking about this and says that ever since the curse, Mr. Raven lost his wife, had one of his buildings burned down, and a worker died while Raven's Court was being built because he fell down the elevator shaft. Both girls are feeling scared about the building being cursed, so Samantha says they will be like Sherlock Holmes and investigate the hotel.
Samantha, what are you doing?
That would not be my
instinct. Does she ever go to an adult for help?
Right. Yeah, that would never be my instinct. Like, I'm scared. I'm going to go off on my own and investigate something. No.
No. I'm not adventurous like that. Neither. I'll be safe in bed. Thanks. Yeah.
Oh, something scary is happening? I'll just be right over there under the covers.
Yep.
That night, Jenny gets Nellie in the middle of the night because Bridget is crying. Now, this part, I will say, I tried to be mindful of like what notes I took down because this book is longer than the other one. So yeah. I'm like, I can't write down every detail.
No.
And this doesn't really, I think, pertain as much to the mystery plot, but I just thought it was really sweet. So there's a scene where Nellie goes to comfort Bridget, who is crying, and Samantha is awake too, so she follows them to their bedroom thinking she can tell a fairy tale. Before she enters, she hears the two little girls asking Nellie to sing them a lullaby their mom used to sing. Samantha thinks about how they've been sisters their whole lives and Samantha has only been their sister for a few months. And again, this scene just made me tear up because I just think how much loss they've gone through, how much trauma, like they've lost both their parents. Just within the last year, it was still recent in this book.
Yeah.
And then also Samantha having that awareness of like,
I should, yeah, give them some space and maybe not interrupt, even though my feelings are maybe hurt that I'm not being included or helpful at that moment, too.
Samantha does head back to her room. And then in a goosebumps like ending, she hears scrabbling sounds behind her head.
So we're not safe in bed either. That's what I'm hearing.
Yes. And I will say, I don't know if you noticed this, but at the end of every single chapter ends exactly like a Goosebumps book.
Yes. Where
there's some kind of mini cliffhanger or scream or something.
Yes.
So I thought that was kind of a fun thing that in a kid's book is just fun to have that when you're reading a mystery.
Yeah. And I feel like as a kid, there were times I had a bedroom in the basement. I moved down there when I was 7 because I wanted my own room. And so my parents helped me make it fun. There was a window outside, so it's like kind of near the ground, and I just like there are always bugs and creepy crawlies, and sometimes there was one time a mouse was in the house and I could hear it running over my head. So this chapter in particular I was relating to in a bad way, and I was like, oh
yeah. Katie and I have talked about house centipedes in basements and
disgusting.
If you have not seen a house centipede, do not Google it. It'll ruin your life. I have some in my house, but we're slowly killing them all off, so it's good. Okay, so Samantha tells herself that what she's hearing is a squirrel, so she goes to sleep. The next morning, Uncle Guard asks Sam to see him off before he leaves for a week for work. While they are in the elevator, he asks Samantha to try not to bother Cornelia because she's been very tired lately. Samantha worries that her and the girls have been bothering Aunt Cornelia too much. Uncle Guard leaves and Martin, the doorman, helps Samantha into the elevator. She notices a slash on his hand, which he quickly dismisses. When Samantha gets back to her floor, there is a 13 in red written over the sign for the 12th floor.
Dun, dun, dun.
Eloise comes by as Samantha is trying to clean it, and she helps her. She says someone is trying to play mean tricks on her dad and asks Samantha to keep an eye out.
And I think at this point, I was convinced that Eloise was the suspect.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Totally was like trying to remember who's playing some pranks and why would Eloise just have a bunch of paints and paint remover available if she didn't do it.
Oh, see, I didn't even pick up that little tidbit of her having paint remover, but that was good.
And I think there's some other moments where they try to maybe put the blame on Eloise. And so I was convinced for most of this book that she was the one because her dad is not absent or is absent. And yeah, she might have been mad.
That's so funny that she is not someone I suspected at all. But I'll tell you who I did suspect in just a minute.
Yeah.
So Samantha realizes, is in this moment that Samantha realizes that the floor that she is on is actually the 13th floor because the ground floor wasn't numbered, as we had mentioned in the beginning of the book. The girls then take a carriage to their schools, which takes almost an hour in the crowded streets. When Samantha is picked up from school, she sees that Jenny and Bridget are no longer there. Nellie explains that there was a chickenpox outbreak, so their school is temporarily closed. Nellie worries the girls will get sick, and it's because of the curse. Samantha remembers how Nellie's parents died of the flu and tries to reassure her. Samantha fills Nellie in on the red painted number, then remembers Martin had a red slash on his hand and wonders if it could have been him. Nellie thinks it was the curse instead. Chapter 5. In the morning, as the girls are leaving, they spy on Martin and see him inspecting the plaque where 13 had been painted the day before. They assume he somehow knew about it. Now, it's so funny because I was just like kind of going through these notes before we were going to come record, because it's only been a few days since I read it, but just to kind of like refresh my memory. And I was, like I said, I was like taking notes as I was reading and just trying to write down anything that might be a clue. And it's funny because now when I go back and read, I'm like, oh, that was a clue. Maybe not in a way that I would have thought, but like, it's cool to see some of the like little details that are clues that you don't realize as you're reading what they're clues to. So it's kind of fun. It almost makes me want to take notes next time I read like an adult mystery.
Yeah.
Just to go back later and see like what.
What did I notice?
Yes. Yeah. Or what did I write down but kind of miss at the same time?
Right.
So the girls get home from school and they learn the two younger girls do have chicken pox. Samantha is shocked to discover Gertrude has been kind to them while they're sick. Nellie starts to sing to the girls and Samantha slips out to read Sherlock Holmes. As they're reading, the phone rings. Normally, a servant would get it, but when nobody does, Samantha decides to answer it the way she's heard Aunt Cornelia answer by saying hello. And here's a little fun fact about that. While the term hello originates from the 1820s, it didn't gain popularity as a greeting until the telephone. Previously, people greeted each other with the time of day, like good morning, good evening. Once people started calling each other across time zones, they needed a neutral greeting. Thus, hello became the popular word used. Thomas Edison is credited for hello's popularity as a telephone greeting.
And that's interesting, too, because I feel like most languages, hello sounds similar to hello, even if it's not English, right? Hello or hola, like those are all very similar. So that's interesting. And then when you also just read that, I was thinking, when you said people greeted each other with a time of day, I was thinking people just walked up to each other and said 8 a.m. And I was like, what is going on here? But good morning or good evening makes a lot more sense. So
I think too, like I said, the term hello had been around previously. And I think that when I was like reading into this, I think they did mention the other languages and said that like hello does stem from like those other languages that sound similar.
Probably Latin. Yeah.
On the line of the phone is Mrs. Pitt, who is Cornelia's mother. She thinks Samantha is Cornelia and scolds her for being there, saying that she is in danger. Samantha cuts her off and goes to get Cornelia. And Samantha is better than me because she does not try to listen to this conversation between Cornelia and her mom. But when it's done, Aunt Cornelia says she needs to leave to visit her mother who is ill, which doesn't really coincide with what Samantha was hearing Cornelia's mom say on the phone.
And I feel like, too, she's better than me because I would have eavesdropped, but I also would have confronted Cornelia and said, what's the danger? Like, why are we in danger? What's going on? And I feel like that's just kind of indicative of the time period where they may be played a little bit more coy around their elders.
Yeah, and it was like, what's that saying that children should be seen and not heard?
Yeah,
I feel like that was
definitely was indicative of that time period.
Yeah. As Cornelia leaves, Samantha suspects she must be afraid of something at Ravenscourt, and wonders why she'd leave them, which is a great question to have as a child. Did you understand why she was leaving, or like have a guess?
I didn't think through the chicken pox piece too much. I thought it was just like, oh, I had to go get my prenatal checkup.
Okay. Yeah, I knew that chicken pox was super dangerous for adults. So that did click in my brain that it was probably for that reason that she was nervous about getting that. But did you have chicken pox?
I think so.
I'm trying to remember when they came out with a vaccine, because I did have it. But I know kids now don't have it.
Or I had the vaccine. I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember what year. I think it's somewhere probably around the time that you were a kid, or potentially slightly after. So I did have it, and My sister was actually hospitalized with chickenpox. Wow. So it's cool that we don't have to worry about that anymore. So Samantha goes to tell the other girls that Aunt Cornelia left when a scream pierces the night, and that ends that chapter. The scream turns out to be the cook, Mrs. Calloway, who has seen a rat. Nellie and Samantha go downstairs to find Mary the maid, who they catch leaning in close to Martin, the doorman. Next, they go tell Eloise about the rat, who seems to think someone brought the rats on purpose to ruin her father. Eloise says that people make things up about her dad and that his tenants are lazy.
I think this is also where I was kind of suspicious of Eloise, because it seems like an unnatural reaction to hear, especially in New York City, about a rat in the building and to immediately go, somebody did that on purpose. Mm. There's no way a rat got in here.
So when we know that
rats can get anywhere, right?
Like, I did think that was kind of weird.
So I thought that was kind of weird. And then I was like, why would she just immediately jump to accusing somebody instead of saying, oh, there could have been a rat?
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't seem that weird to me. I don't know.
That is weird. I did think it was weird when she said that she was shocked that rats could be in there, but I didn't necessarily think that that painted her as guilty, but I did notice that too, that that was strange. Nellie does speak out though, because, you know, obviously Eloise was pretty offensive just then, saying that the tenants were lazy of her dad. And so Nellie speaks out and says her dad is a hard landlord. And honestly, like, Nellie was not super rude or anything. She just was like, hey, your dad's like kind of a difficult
just
person.
You know.
And Eloise got mad at them and asks them to leave. The girls leave and they talk about how they heard the rats previously. That was the quote unquote squirrel that Samantha heard. And Samantha wants to share with Nellie that she thinks Cornelia left because she was scared of something. But, and this is just like such a testament to her character, she didn't want to seem disloyal to Cornelia. So she ends up not saying anything to Nellie, which we've had multiple instances like this in other books where Samantha is shown to be very loyal to the people she loves. At this point, I'm wondering, so like, this is where I started to get a theory of who it was. And I was wondering if maybe it was Martin, the doorman, because they go out of their way to mention he has red hair. And so this was sort of like a leap. But I was like, well, maybe they mentioned that to indicate that he's Irish. And where Nellie was living, perhaps there was a lot of Irish people. So maybe he's like a former tenant who wants to get back at Mr. Raven. But then I also thought, I was like, I don't know that they would make the bad guy be a former tenant, because I feel like the point of these books is not to say that the working class were bad people. So I also was like, I don't know if the bad person is going to be someone who is like working class, but that was something that kind of just flitted through my mind, is like maybe Martin is the guy who is the bad guy.
And I didn't think of this when I was reading the book either, but now that you mentioned the red hair, I immediately went red herring.
Oh
yeah. Like, which I knew, I couldn't remember if it was Martin or not, like, to be honest. But now that I'm like reading that back, that is such a literal interpretation.
Yes.
Of that distraction. So that's kind of interesting.
Because, and I mean, we are spoiling this whole book, so hopefully no one is annoyed. But like, he I'm was a red herring
ahead of time. Yes.
he wasn't it. I was wrong. But Eloise stops by and says she wants to see her dad's buildings for herself. Nellie says that she'll take her, and Samantha insists on going too, even though it's dangerous. She says that if Nellie was brave enough to live there, Samantha can be brave enough to visit. Chapter 7, the next morning, the two girls got dressed in their plainest school clothes to walk to Nellie's old neighborhood. The three girls leave where Eloise first takes them to Macy's to pick out candy, because that is what she told Gertrude they were doing. And so I did a little bit of a look into Macy's, because I'm always shocked when like stores that are around today were around back then, even though it's not that long ago, honestly. But Macy's was founded in 1858. The store they go to in the book is the current flagship store, and it was opened in 1902. So it would have been a fairly new building when they went there. And then this is sort of a sad fact, but two brothers, Isidore and Nathan Strauss, end up buying Macy's from the Macy's family in the late 1800s. And then tragically, Isidore died on the Titanic with his wife. So there's a connection between Macy's and the Titanic. So I thought that was sad, but also kind of interesting. So I thought I'd put that in there. But let's get back to the story. So You know me, I'm going to want to take note of any food or snacks that are mentioned. So I did write down what they got at Macy's. So Eloise got some licorice. Samantha got a peppermint stick and Nellie got a lemon stick. And I'm picturing that it's those like candy sticks that are sort of like a candy cane, but thicker, and they don't have the stem or like the hook, I should say. And my sister and I used to get those all the time, I think, because I feel like you could get them when I was a kid for like 10 cents at places like Cracker Barrel. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just like an easy thing for my parents to be like, yeah, you can pick out one or two because they were so cheap. And I feel like you can still get those at like old fashioned candy stores and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I was like interested. This is a total side note because I love all of those like old New York kind of like myths and stuff, or not myths, but just time period, and just how different it was from today. And I was like, Macy's for candy? Like, that's what we're going to Macy's for? So I would love to go to the flagship store. I feel like it's just, when I hear Macy's from the Midwest, it does not have illusions of grandeur, but the Macy's in New York just does. So I need to visit someday.
I've been to New York twice, and the first time I went, it was Christmas, or it was like late November. And we specifically went to Macy's and it was super fun and cool. And like, just to have all the Christmas decor up and stuff, I would recommend it. It was awesome. But the ones that, like, at our local mall, I don't think have quite that same feeling.
And I think department stores in general had such a different connotation back in the early 1900s, even like through, I'm thinking of a scene. I already mentioned Mrs. Maisel in our last episode,
but yeah.
I think of that time frame too, and just how grand they were. So
my dad grew up in Detroit in the, like, he was born in the late 50s, and him and his siblings talk about going to Hudson's, I think it was called, which was a department store there, and just like how much of an event it was to even just go to this store and how it kind of lives large in their memories. But I do not believe it is in business any longer. But all right, let's jump back into the story. So they leave Macy's, they make it to Nellie's old neighborhood. The building that they were looking for does have a raven on it, just like the apartment that they're living at now. They knock on one of the apartments, and a woman Samantha feels like she recognizes opens the door. She tells them that the grandma who cursed Mr. Raven, her family still lives upstairs, but the grandma passed away last winter. They head up to the apartment where her family lives, and Eloise invites herself inside. A young girl is there with her 3-year-old little sister. The rest of her family are at work in the factories. Samantha gives the 3-year-old her peppermint candy, and she sees lice on this little girl's head. Eloise asks them why it's so cold in there, and the young girl says that it's because they don't have money for coal.
I just feel like the imagery in this section of the book in particular was just so like visceral. Like, mm-hmm. And you could just feel the depression that existed in this building, and just it makes you feel even more for Nellie and just all she and her sisters have come through. And just the fact that conditions like these still exist today.
Yes. I will say one thing that made me feel a little bit better, I guess, during this part of the book was that, I don't think I wrote it in my notes, but they do mention, so the first woman that they talk to, later on, they run into her again as they're leaving, and she's like laughing with a young man. And so it did make me feel like, you know,
there's still joy.
Yes, there's still joy. But it was a sad scene. And these poor two little girls that mm-hmm. were alone in their cold
apartment.
Yeah. So Eloise is a little bit short with these girls, but she does give them a fistful of money and tells them to buy food and coal with it. So that was kind of a nice thing that ended up happening at the end, at least. And at this point in the book, I thought about Rebecca, the American Girl Rebecca. Okay. Did you ever read those books?
I have not yet.
So she is from 1914, I believe. Right. And I feel like she lives in one of these types of buildings.
Okay.
Like, I think that's part of her storyline, is like she immigrated to America and her family doesn't have a ton of money and they live in a tenement. I think it's called a tenement house. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious how much her book might
overlap with
with like what we're learning about with this. And then this chapter ends with Samantha realizing why that woman looks familiar. So that's the cliffhanger for chapter 7. And then chapter 8, Samantha asks if the woman that they ran into in the apartment knows who Mary Crosby is, and then remember, that's their maid in their current apartment. This woman says yes, Mary is her cousin
and used to live there.
Yes. They leave and have to take the subway back since Eloise gave away most of her money. While on the subway, Nellie spots Cornelia in a crowd as she exits the station. While they have, so like that, they don't really go into it there, but that, you know, that's definitely part of the mystery of like, okay, well, she's not with her mom. So yeah,
what's Cornelia up to?
Yes. While they had been away, the two younger girls were feeling a bit better and rode the service elevator with Mary to the cellar. After dinner, when it was just Samantha and Nellie, Samantha confesses she's not sure if Cornelia ever left to visit her mom in Connecticut and that she thinks she is scared of something.
Maybe Cornelia was the one buying rats and painting 13s.
That would sure be a twist.
That would be a huge twist, yeah.
While trying to guess what's going on, Nellie thinks maybe Cornelia is tired of them and doesn't want them around anymore.
Aww.
Samantha is worried for a second, then reminds Nellie that Cornelia didn't have to take them in, but wanted to. They decide to write a list of clues regarding the curse. One they add in is that Mary lied about not knowing Nellie's old neighborhood, so that was a clue. Chapter 9. The next morning, Eloise asks the girls if they want to go for a walk in Central Park. They run into Mr. Raven's rival, Mr. Enderby. So this is the man who has the building next to Raven's Court. And he smirks at them regarding all of the things going wrong in the building. Eloise asks what Nellie would do first if she were the landlord of her father's building. Nellie suggests fixing the windows. She adds that they could also use more bathrooms as well. When they get back to the apartment, they hear a crash as the service elevator falls. The girls wonder how that could have happened, and Mr. Winthrop says that Mr. Raven only sprung for safety elevators where guests would use them, as Katie had mentioned earlier. Eloise orders that the service workers use the guest elevators from now on until they replace the service elevators with safer ones. So good for Eloise. When Samantha and Nellie get home, they find out Bridget and Jenny had been playing in the service elevator just half an hour before the crash. Luckily, they are okay. That night, Samantha is awakened by a white hand opening her door. Next chapter, the hand leaves a note on Samantha's dresser. When she finally gets the courage to read it, it's from Mary and says she's left because she has chicken pox and Samantha should too because it's not safe there. Samantha wants to try to convince Mary to stay, and she slips into the service entrance to find her. She goes down the servants' stairs until she gets to the cellar. And I will say, to me, this was probably the creepiest part of the book.
I was reading this at night, and yeah, I was like, why am I a little creeped out right now? I know this ends well. I know it's a kid's book, but here I am.
Yeah.
Turning on my lights.
It was a little creepy. And I think just like the descriptive writing and
yes,
just picturing
a white hand sneaking through the door.
Yeah. And then going down what it would be like 12 flights of stairs or whatever. You're in the dark by yourself. Yeah. Very scary. Once she's in the cellar, she calls out for Mary, but nobody answers. As she's about to head back, she hears a man say, "You can't leave, not now." She then hears Mary speaking back to the man, who isn't Mr. Winthrop, but she can't tell who it is. Mary says he's gone too far with the curse stuff and lists the broken boilers, the 13, the rats, and the elevator. So now we know that it isn't a curse, but it is someone actually doing this. Mary storms off and Samantha is left hiding in the cellar with the mysterious man. She notices he has a dim light that moves about him, and she says he must have a pocket torch, which I did find this odd since torch is a British word for flashlight. Apparently, pocket flashlights were invented in 1899 by a British inventor, which might explain the name. So maybe because it was from England originally, Americans were calling them pocket torches.
Maybe. I had definitely a picture of a torch in my head at this moment, like a mini one. Well, it's kind of funny.
And I only knew that term because I had listened to a book by Tana French, an audiobook, and she's an Irish author and she writes mysteries. My dad and I listened to it on a road trip from Phoenix, Arizona to Michigan. And she mentions the word torch. And I think my dad must have noticed my face look confused because he was like, "That's a flashlight." Like, but that's what they call it.
Makes sense. But yeah, that's a word I learned today.
Finally, the man with the pocket torch leaves and Samantha is left alone in darkness. Suddenly, she hears another man's footsteps. It is Mr. Winthrop who says, "Martin, what are you doing down here?" Martin says the lights just went out and he came down to fix them. Suddenly, a dim light begins to glow again in the cellar. With the glow of the light, Samantha sneaks back to the stairs and rushes back to her floor. Once in her room, Nellie comes in and tells her that there's something on her face. It's dust from the cellar, and Samantha tells Nellie the whole story. I wrote a note here that at this point, I realized that when I'm picturing the girls in my head, I picture Samantha to look like her illustrations, and I picture Nellie to look like the doll. So
I picture Nellie to look like the movie version, who is so perfectly cast, but also looks just like the doll.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know what she looks like, but I'm excited.
Yeah, Nellie looks to me, I think they based Nellie's doll off of her later illustrations before her hair got cut at the orphanage and like kind of when she had that bob. So I feel like that's how I picture her too.
Yeah. I should say as well that these books do not have pictures in them. So it differs from the original series in that way.
Makes me a little sad because I wanted to see all the illustrations from these ones too.
Yeah. No illustrations. And they're quite a bit longer too.
Yes.
I think this book was like 160 some pages. Mm-hmm. They're smaller pages, but it's all text. So
yes.
So they decide that they can't tell Mr. Winthrop what happened because they don't want Mary to get in trouble. The girls decide that if Cornelia isn't home by when they get back from school the next day, they will tell Eloise about what happened in the cellar. In chapter 11, this is like the least notes I took, so I don't think like a lot happened in this. It's like, I think a chapter to get from point A to point B, basically. But the next day, Samantha and Nellie go out on the balcony with Jenny and Bridget to get some fresh air. While out there, Samantha hears crunching on the roof. Nellie wants to go investigate, so they head up to the roof. They duck behind the chimney and see something in the corner.
Dun, dun, dun. Again.
Now we're getting to the final chapter. So chapter 12, they see a man with a hammer in his hand who is working on one of the ravens. They finally see that it's Mr. Winthrop. They start to make their way toward him when he pries the bird off the wall and it falls to the ground below. Nellie gasps and Mr. Winthrop sees them. He tells the girl that the raven was loose and he was trying to tighten it. While he says this, Samantha notices he no longer has his English accent that he used to have. Such an interesting thing to fake.
Yes.
Samantha thinks more and realizes he was not tightening the raven but prying it loose. Also, he sounds like the person who was speaking to Mary now that he doesn't have his English accent. She's like, oh, actually, he maybe was the voice in the cellar.
Yeah.
Mr. Winthrop tries to gaslight them that the bird falling was their fault, and the girls agree to just appease him and get out of there. They try to leave, but Mr. Winthrop grabs Samantha and tells her she must keep what she saw a secret. Nellie kicks him in the shin. They start to run, but he grabs both of them by their collars and starts to pull them. So I was a little bit
nervous. Spooky. Yes. First of all, like, what is he planning to do? Hands off. And I'm also like, why are you going to such these lengths to protect yourself against these two 11-year-olds when you're the adult and you could have just said, they spooked me and I accidentally pushed it off. I don't know.
Literally said anything. I'm so curious, like, what were you planning to do with them after you dragged them? Like, again, spoiler, but he's going to get interrupted. But like,
yeah,
what was his plan there? So he does get interrupted because Samantha hears a crack and sees Aunt Cornelia there with her umbrella, which she used to smack Mr. Winthrop. She tells him to take his hands off her daughters. This reminds me of Molly Weasley.
Yes, very much so.
Martin comes up behind, panting and holding a gun. He aims it at Mr. Winthrop and tells him to put his hands behind his back. He releases the two girls and they run to Aunt Cornelia. Martin handcuffs Mr. Winthrop and lets him know that he's an undercover detective.
There we go.
So I was right there, something going on with him, but completely wrong with what it was, because he was not the culprit. He is, in fact, investigating.
And I forgot what his role was. So when this came out, I was like, oh, yeah.
That was actually my favorite twist personally, because I just felt like both Mary and Winthrop weren't huge surprises to me, because I'm like, clearly there's someone on the inside helping.
Mm-hmm.
And then who the big bad is was not a surprise at all either, which will be revealed in just a minute. But I thought that the Martin thing to me was a surprise. I did not expect there to be an undercover cop. So I thought that was cool.
And you want him to, I think, just be a good person throughout too, because he's being like bullied by Mr. Winthrop.
And, yeah. So it's like a good, nice surprise. The girls explain everything and how Mr. Winthrop was behind it all. Winthrop confesses and says it is Enderby's idea. And so remember, this is the rival of Mr. Raven. Yes. As they are leaving, Uncle Guard shows up on the roof as well. Martin explains everything to Uncle Gard, including how he was hired by Mr. Raven to investigate all of the accidents. When they get to their apartment, the four girls fill Uncle Gard and Aunt Cornelia in on everything. But Samantha and Nellie don't mention seeing Aunt Cornelia at the subway station again, loyal to their core. Uncle Gard says they're packing up and going home, even if the renovations aren't done yet. As they are packing to leave, Eloise stops by. She says her dad is thrilled to finally have won over Mr. Enderby, who will have to pay for his crimes. She convinced her father to use the money he will get from Mr. Enderby to pay to make his buildings nicer. Then people will stop talking about the curse and only talk about how nice he is. So
go figure, being nice could be a good business plan.
Totally. I know, it's like common sense really, but not everyone has that, I guess. The chapter ends with Uncle Gard letting everyone know there are some surprises in the renovations to their home. So in chapter 14, the final chapter, they all go up to the attic of Aunt Cornelia and Uncle Gard's home to look at the beautiful new space. There are also three cottages on the wall of the attic that would be their rooms. One that says Samantha and Nellie, one that says Jenny and Bridget, and one that is blank. All of a sudden, Nellie starts to cry. When they ask her what's wrong, she said she was thinking they didn't want them anymore. Aunt Cornelia asks what gave her that idea, and Samantha and Nellie look at each other. Finally, Samantha apologizes and spills the beans about what she knows about Cornelia leaving. Cornelia confesses that she left because she wasn't sure if she'd ever had chicken pox, and it can be very dangerous for adults. She was able to come back, however, because her mom thought to telegraph the nanny and found out that Cornelia had had them when she was two. I feel like, how would you not remember your own child getting chicken pox? But
that, and I also was like, could she have not just said that to the girls? So
yeah, because you don't have to be pregnant to still be worried about getting chicken pox as an adult,
right?
Especially, I'm sure, in that time period,
right?
But
and she could have just said, like, I really don't want to leave. I don't want to get chicken pox because it's very serious for adults, and I want to be here to take care of you. Yeah. So,
well, I guess she does say that the reason she didn't say all that is because she didn't want to scare them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess she didn't know that they knew that her mom wasn't sick. So, right. Like, I think in her mind, she probably, it was a kinder thing, I guess, to tell
probably.
Them. But still, it's just convoluted.
You're protecting your kids as much as you know how.
Yeah. I'm a parent now, and I do lie to Veda all the time. It's like little things.
You have to.
Yeah. So Jenny asks about the third cottage, and Aunt Cornelia says it's for a new baby because she is pregnant. Uncle Gard says they don't know if it will be a boy or a girl, but they do know they'll never love her or him more than they love their four beautiful daughters they already have. And that is the end of the book.
Happy ending in true American Girl fashion.
Yes. Very sweet. So, Katie, what would you rate this book?
I would give it a 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5?
I feel like, I don't know why it doesn't have a 5 out of 5, but there's just something maybe a little bit off to me about maybe the pace of the writing or just some of the like adult behavior, I feel like. I don't know.
Yeah, I also give it a 4 out of 5. And it's interesting because in a lot of ways, I like this better than some of the original books because I love a mystery and I loved the spooky vibes. But same as you, like, I can't quite put my finger on why it doesn't feel like a 5 out of 5, whereas a lot of Samantha's books do feel that way for me. And I don't know if it's just because it's a lot longer. So like, because it's longer, you want a little bit more from it. So like you said, like the pacing of it maybe is a little off because there were a few parts that were maybe slower. But yeah, overall, very good.
Yes.
I liked it a lot. And I am excited to read mysteries from the other girls, too. Like, I think that will be a fun thing. Hopefully we can incorporate a little bit throughout this podcast.
I am, too. And I think this one, even though it was a mystery and it does definitely have a little bit more serious of a tone than some of the other books, just the way mysteries are written, I do think it also just fits into Samantha's universe really well. Even though it's a different author, and I think they do a good job of still maintaining the characterization of the characters too.
Yes. I think that was ultimately my favorite thing about it is that you do feel, it doesn't feel like it's sort of this tacked on money grab.
Right.
It feels like it's still a part of her series. You're learning more about her and Nellie and Uncle Garden and et cetera. Like it's just, a continuation.
And it just feels like, hey, let's continue these characters for maybe some older readers who want a little bit more.
Yeah. So, Katie, it looks like you wanted to talk about maybe one of the outfits for the doll that could potentially go with this book a little bit. And what was that?
Yes. So we've mentioned it before. I'm going to mention it again, but the only illustration for this book is Samantha on the cover and on the back cover, which is the same image. And it's Samantha in her nightgown and pajamas as she's sneaking down or up the stairs from visiting the cellar. So I threw in her nightgown here because I love it. It is a white long sleeved, like ankle length nightgown. It's got like a really lacy high collar, and then it's trimmed with pink ribbons and bows, and it's just so cute. And then on the cover too, you can see her pink kimono and slippers. So this was also introduced to Samantha's collection in 1987 and then retired in 2008. So it came with her collection, but and has kind of seen in some of her other books, but I feel like this one features it obviously the most out of everything. So her kimono is like a pink satin long sleeved robe, and then there's like a bouquet pattern in white on it as well. And then her slippers are just like white crocheted slippers, so super cute pajamas.
It's funny because I did not notice that that was the thing she was wearing on the cover. I know what her pajamas look like, so I don't know why I just didn't click. I didn't even pay attention to that, but thank you for noticing. And as I said, I think in maybe episode or like when we did book one, Meet Samantha, that is something I want to own eventually. So hopefully, because yes. it does look so nice. And then let's finish this episode with talking about some media pairings. So Katie, do you have any recommendations that might go along with this book?
I do. So the first one that jumped into my head as I was reading this was a book I loved in seventh grade called The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. So it is a mystery, a lot more quirky than this one is, but also kind of takes place in this really luxurious house in a luxurious like setting. There's like a contest going on, I believe, and I'm not going to spoil anything. And I also don't remember everything, but lots of quirky characters in that one. And the main character's name is Turtle, and I just love that. So definitely a fun, quirky mystery. And then the other one that popped into my head is a popular show right now called Only Murders in the Building. So this one takes place at one of these luxurious apartment complexes in New York. It is also a murder mystery. So a little bit for older audiences here, but the setting and the location, I think, especially for that one, makes me think of this building that they were living in and New York's kind of style and history.
I love both of your recommendations so much. The Westing Game is one of my absolute favorite books.
I love it so much.
If you have not read it, I didn't read it till I was an adult. Absolutely love it.
Yes.
So good. And Only Murders in the Building, perfect recommendation. That is also just such a fun fall show to watch too. This is one of my favorite, I don't know if trope is even the right word, but like I love that setting of a mystery in an elaborate house or apartment or hotel. Like, I just love it. It's kind of like a cozy, fun mystery
vibe.
Give
me the trapdoors, all of the fun.
Yes.
I think it kind of reminds me of like playing in a clubhouse as a kid.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think also growing up with like the game Clue.
Yes.
And some people might remember the game 13 Dead End Drive. That was something that I didn't realize anyone else had ever played. Like, it just seemed like something that was in my childhood alone, but Victor knows about it as well, so some listeners
I've never heard of it, so I'm gonna have to check it out.
It's kind of like, I want to say, Mousetrap meets Clue.
I love that,
but it's really fun. Anyway, I love that whole vibe, and I have a handful of recommendations too. The first is The Shining. I feel like that's just kind of like spooky
classic
hotel.
Yep.
And then I do have a book that I feel like most people probably have not read. I don't think it was super popular, but I want to say it came out somewhere around 2016-ish. It's called Security by Gina Woolsdorf, and it is about the opening of a fancy hotel, so similar to this. But in this book, the staff are killed off one by one. So my favorite trope, I will say this, my favorite trope is a closed circle mystery, which is like the movie Clue or the book And Then There Were None, where there's a set group of people and they are dying off one by one. I love that trope. And anyway, this kind of follows that. And it's also set in a hotel and just has a really, it's very atmospheric. I really enjoyed reading that book. I think I read it in one night. Another one is a comic series called Goldie Vance. This series centers on Goldie Vance, a 16-year-old daughter of the manager of a Miami resort whose dream is to become the resort's in-house detective. And so I would say it is very similar in plot to these, to like to this book, except that it is not really spooky. It's more mystery focused.
Yeah.
And then finally, I did just want to note the two pieces of media that are mentioned in the book. We talked about Sherlock Holmes quite a bit in this recap, but they do mention The Hounds of Baskerville, and then they also mention The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. So I feel like if you're going to read this, again, if you're going to read this with kids too, those might be two fun books or stories to pair with this one.
So many great recommendations. And I feel like we can't be the only two who love this trope or style and setting, because there's so many great stories. I'm like, even as we're talking, like Jane the Virgin is set in a hotel and there's a lot of shady stuff going on and more crime than maybe mystery. But just such a great, like, cozy feeling for some reason. I don't know why.
Agreed.
I was actually in a hotel and people were being murdered. That doesn't feel very cozy. But
no.
Such a fun genre.
Yes. And because Halloween is 3 days away, I know I said we're going to end at media pairings, but one last thing. What is your favorite or one of your favorite like Halloween movies to watch, or maybe a recent one? You're starting some new ones that you have never seen before.
Yes.
So what's a recommendation you can give just that's Halloween or that vibe?
Yes. So I was telling Grace, I am very into watching and trying to catch up on the kitschy Halloween horror films. So Goosebumps, Clue, all of those kind of things. So I did just watch Gremlins and I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would ever enjoy that, maybe that series or that kind of style movie. And it was a very campy, cozy Halloween vibe movie, even though it takes place at Christmas. So
yeah, but could be a fun one to watch. Maybe a good November movie to bridge the gap between Halloween and Christmas.
Can't decide. Here's both.
Yes. My favorite is so basic. I love Hocus Pocus. Like, I
that's
have to
a
watch.
Great one.
Yeah, I watch it every year. Like I said, I just love a good family
centered
Halloween movie.
And Hocus Pocus 2, also good.
It was also good. For the first time in a long time this year, I watched Double Double Toil and Trouble, which is a Mary Kay and Ashley Olsen movie. And I watched it
with my daughter and Victor.
And it wasn't like the best, but it wasn't bad. Like, it was kind of fun to watch. So
yeah,
I would keep your expectations lower
to the 90s Halloween genre. Yeah.
But it was fun. So that was
and we'll
fun.
Have lots more to say on Mary Kate and Ashley when we get to Nikki and Isabel. So
yes,
there's that.
True. I'm excited for that. All right. Well, I think that wraps up our episode today. We thank you for listening. We hope you have a very spooky and fun filled Halloween, and we hope you tune into a future episode soon.